Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and it's a beautiful fall afternoon. We're here, as usual, at Roberta's Pizza, but it's a very fitting environment to be talking with our current guest today. He's just published a book called DiPaolo's Guide to the Essential Foods of Italy. And I had the pleasure of actually meeting Mr. DiPaolo at a food event a few weeks ago, and it was very clear within a very short amount of time that his depth of knowledge about regional Italian foods and particularly cheeses at that event is astronomical. So I'm very excited that you've, thank you very much for coming out with this book. And so we may glean maybe a fraction of your knowledge about Italian food.
Well, it's great to be here. And, you could call me Lou.
Okay.
Okay, and, absolutely.
This is Lou DiPaolo, by the way.
we've been very privileged to represent not only the Italian immigrants here in New York City, mm-hmm. but the Italian foods of Italy.
Absolutely.
For over 100 years.
So to back up a little bit, DiPaolo's is a store in Little Italy in Manhattan, and it is one of those places that many people refer to as a New York institution, in that it's more so much more than a store, but a hallmark of heritage in the city, sort of like we would call Katz's Deli. So 140 years.
104.
104.
Going back to my great-grandfather, Savino DiPaolo,
right.
1910. He settled in New York City's Little Italy in 1903 and opened the first shop in 1910. A simple latteria.
Right.
What is a latteria? A dairy. And today we continue that same tradition as he started, making the cheese all by hand, fresh
mm-hmm.
dairy.
And you've been running it for 40 years now.
Well, and let's put it this way. I've been one of the caretakers for the last 40 years plus. Because when we say who's running the store, who's the owner of the store, I always point to a wall and we have this mosaic of a photograph of my grandfather and my grandmother. And we always point to them and say, they're the owners,
mm-hmm.
we're just the caretakers.
And you learned how to make cheese from an uncle of yours who had another latteria in the city.
It was my great-uncle.
Okay.
My great-uncle, my grandmother's brother. And it was a curious situation, I wanted to learn how to make the cheese and my father would always put me off on it and say, mm-hmm. he said, go to Uncle Morris. Go to Uncle Morris. He had a shop in Brooklyn in Red Hook. So I said, okay. So I used to go after school. I used to go to Uncle Morris's place and I used to go there. And one by one, he used to show me how to make this cheese, ricotta, another one, cacciotto, finally the fresh mozzarella. And I went to my father. I said, Dad, how come you never wanted to teach me. How come you had no patience to teach your son? And he looked at me and he said, who do you think taught me how to make the cheese? It was Uncle Morris.
Okay.
Because it was my father's uncle, my great uncle.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a certain comfort in knowing that my father wanted me to learn from who taught him.
Your father wanted you to know the best possible way to know how to make cheese, estimation.
And I realized that, how important it was for him to have me go there.
Right. Well, we also have a guest today who knows a little bit more than me about the foods of Italy, because she traveled with Lou throughout Italy a couple times to help write this book. It's Rachel Wharton.
Hello. I also wanted to say that the latteria where you learned, you can still see the sign on the wall of the building, there's paintings. It's on Union, right? You can still see the paintings of the cheeses that they used to make up on the wall.
On Union?
If you're on the BQE, you can look up and see that they're still painted on the wall of the building.
Union and Hick Street.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So it's like Carroll Gardens. Uh-huh. Yeah, okay.
It's like the waterfront. They call it the waterfront district now, right?
Right. Okay, Red Hook. Carter. Great. So tell me a little bit about making this book. I know you guys did some traveling and to capture like a lot of the stories. And I thought it was really interesting how you said, you know, talking about making fresh cheeses when you went to Italy, you saw people making cheeses just like Uncle Morris was.
You see, when I started to go back to Italy over 40 years ago, mm-hmm. actually the one and only time in about 70 trips to Italy that I went there for, I guess you could call it a vacation, it was my honeymoon. It was then when I realized, I used to get my wife Connie up every morning early. I said, come on, we got to go to this cheese factory, we got to go to this prosciutto factory. And she went along with it. She was a young girl at the time, very young, and she went along with it. But it was then when I realized that I needed to really get involved and understand not only the method of making the cheese, but actually the traditions behind it. I had needed to meet the people that have done it for generations, even way before mm-hmm. my family had done it.
And I love a quote from you in the book. You said, I want to see the traditions of every product that I sell. I want to see the passion. I want to meet the little farmer. I want to see how it was done hundreds of years ago rather than how it is automated today. So, and then that, in turn, over the last several decades, you've been bringing in a lot of different products other than, you know, cheese to sell at this now not only a latteria, but a store.
Absolutely. We have expanded our business over 100 years. Originally, mm-hmm. a small latteria, my grandfather, my great-grandfather both. Then my father and my uncle continued. They added more items like some salumi, which is cured meats and cooked meats of Italy, pastas. When we continued the business, my sister Marie, my brother Sal, and myself, we started to expand into a lot of specialty items of Italy. As I went to Italy, I rediscovered these new, old products. What mm-hmm. I mean by new, products that haven't really been represented well in the United States.
Okay.
And I needed to bring them to the attention of the American consumer. And today, the fifth generation, our children, continue expanding our business in Italian wines and spirits. So as I mentioned before, we represent the Italian immigrants, but we also represent Italy mm-hmm. today through the foods of Italy. And that's the mission that we have taken.
At DePaolo's.
Never losing sight of where we came from, our roots.
Right.
The small latteria, we always remain that. And it came time that I needed to document this. Document mm-hmm. it for the previous generations, for the sacrifices they made to help us have a better life today. But at the same time, I was a realist. I'm a cheesemaker. I'm a cheese mm-hmm. guy. I'm not a writer. And I needed someone that had the experience in writing and someone that had the love of food.
Right.
And someone that would understand 100% my voice. And I found that person in Rachel. And I was very fortunate for the last 2.5 years to work with Rachel. And I wanted to give her the opportunity to share some of my experiences in Italy. And I brought it to the special places in Italy that mean very much to mm-hmm. me and shared that experience of passion of those people. So she can understand when I speak how to really put it down mm-hmm. in script. She did a fantastic job.
Thank you. I was actually just sitting here thinking that I only tried to make mozzarella once, and I really should try at least another time.
Well, so what were you blown away with when you went to Italy and you saw some of these favorite spots?
Oh, I mean, well, all of it. And it's mm-hmm. we did so much in such a short amount of time. It's like packed away in my brain. And then I look back at my pictures and I was like, oh my God, we did that and we did that and we did that. And that was all in like one morning. Typically, where to even begin? I mean, the second trip, which we took last June to Basilicata, where Lou's great grandfather was from. When you mentioned the little farmer, there was a little farmer, and he he made fresh cheeses in a little, like an old, like a cave, pretty much under his house. And he cooked. He did everything that Lou does, but he did it over a cauldron over a wood fire. It was totally amazing to me that he still did it that way.
Not automated at all.
No, not in the least.
Yeah,
and he made everything from scratch. And Lou, what's the cheese where the butter's inside?
It's called manteca or burini.
Whoa.
And
watching him make it was amazing.
And that tradition was a way to recapture mm-hmm. the fat of the cheese that's lost when you're making one cheese.
Uh-huh.
And that fat is literally butter fat. And by recooking it and working it up to a more thicker consistency and then extruding the excess moisture out of it,
mm-hmm.
you would place it in the middle of the pasta filata, which is basically a stretches of mozzarella.
Okay.
And that would preserve that butter fat.
So it's kind of like burrata, but
no,
butter? No.
It's the same concept of okay. burrata, taking waste into wages, so
mm-hmm.
to speak.
But that's cream with burrata, right?
Burrata,
no?
Burrata is also the butter fat, but then it's mixed with shreds of the mozzarella that was never congealed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Today we don't make burrata that way. We make burrata with fresh cream and using fresh stretches of the
Whoa.
Mozzarella.
I think I like the sound of the one with the leftover shreds.
Well,
and the
that was a way
cool.
to recapture what was lost in the process of making the initial cheese.
Sounds great.
And the butter, too, because he kind of collected spuma, is what you, right? That's where he collected it.
Spuma was the excess fat that rose as you recook. He called it ricotta. Mm-hmm. And ricotta simply means recooked.
Mm-hmm.
And when you would take the hot pot where you had all this butter fat that had accumulated, and you heated that temperature up to a very high temperature, approximately 180 degrees, what bubbled up to the top was that the layer of fat, leaving the water below it, and he would collect all that spuma or crema or whatever you want to call it, the dialect of spuma, and rework it, allow it to set and dry a little bit, then rework it, squeeze out any excess moisture, and then you would have literally what I like to call whey butter. It's the most delicious,
yes.
creamiest.
It's like cultured butter, but better.
Cheesy butter.
Yeah, huh. It's really
cheesy
good.
Butter. That's exactly the way I could describe it.
And he kneaded it. Like he kneaded it with his gnarled hands, and he did it all with just his hands.
And you know what's lost for years, up until I was maybe 11 or 12 years old. I remember my father used to collect all that leftover fat. And put it in the big milk cans, you know, those milk cans, that mm-hmm. double-handled milk cans. And then just put it aside in the refrigerator. When he had it, half a dozen cans, he would call this fella up. He'd come and he would collect them. And at the time, he would pay my father $25 for a milk can. And I said, Dad, what is he going to do with that? You know, this is fat that was maybe 2 weeks old. Oh, he's going to make butter with it. And he would go and he would take that and add it to more fresh cream and mm-hmm. make butter. And then he would pack the butter in these sort of like pillow packs, and then he would go and sell it.
Mm.
He would sell it back to us, and we would sell that butter. And literally, it had a cheesy flavor to it.
It's really good.
And that's what we used to use to make the manteca as well. We used to form it. We never really did the traditional way that the farmer
with the cauldron,
got it.
Yeah.
Right. But we used to use the butter that this fella made, so it was
wow.
It was really great. We still make that, by the way, manteca.
And it's still pop. I mean, all these cheeses that you're preserving, the heritage, the other products, which we can get into. It's still. I mean, it's not like this antiquated, you know, niche thing. I mean, the lines outside of DiPaolo will certainly tell that it is beloved.
Well, you know, the lines come. Are for a couple of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
One, we like to think they're there because everybody wants something special, and mm-hmm. we certainly have that to offer them. But it also comes with the fact that when your turn comes, we take a lot of time with
yeah.
each and every customer. It's not how many people we serve, it's how we serve the people. And it does take a little bit of time. Sometimes people get a little frustrated or ornery about it, and they get a little annoyed and all. But they know when their turn comes, they're going to get the best quality, the best service, and we'd like to think at a reasonable price. Because the best is not cheap.
Mm-hmm.
We try not to be expensive, but unfortunately, when you buy something of a very high quality, it costs a little
right.
bit more.
So that extra level of service is certainly something that is not what you see every day today as well, as in the making, the automated, you know, methods that you see today with the products.
I like to say there's a right way to do mm-hmm. things, a wrong way, and there's my grandmother's way. And we maintain that tradition of my grandmother's way in service as well as quality.
Yeah, most modern stores try as hard as they can to make it so that you don't have to actually talk. The customer and the person working there don't have to talk.
There is no person there.
Right. You can, in some yeah. supermarkets, you can even check yourself out. And
right,
the Apollo's,
right.
and this didn't really sink into me. I mean, I'd been there many, many times as a customer, but it didn't really sink in until I started working on the book, how different it is. There's no product information written down. There's
right.
often not prices. So you have to have a conversation, and then you learn more about it, and it's really, really nice.
Figure out what's there. John, did you have something to say?
Oh, no, I'm okay.
Okay.
I was just going to touch on like the forcefulness and all these new places where you buy artisan food.
How they do that. They want to bring that back, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Connection.
I appreciate that for sure. Okay, we're going to have a quick little commercial interlude, and we'll be right back chatting more about this book, which we've only skimmed the surface of.
Listening to Snow Mine, Hologram.
Forgot just what it felt like to feel his bones burning inside. Loneliness is only love's hologram. It hangs above your head just like a star. For when you know it's burning out, you give it one last snort, and then it's gone. And then it's gone.
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards and Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
This is Clay Gordon of thechocolatelife.com, and you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, we're back chatting with Lou DiPaolo, author of DiPaolo's Guide to the Essential Foods of Italy, and the co-writer, Rachel Wharton, and also John Taggart, who's hanging out here, photographer extraordinaire. Okay, we talked a little bit about cheese, but this book is also divided into sections that explore vinegar, sea salt, olive, and olive oil, and coffee. So why these groups? And of course, within them, there's a lot of other talk, like prosciutto, pasta,
You know, it's
was it hard to?
It's very hard.
Categories.
It's very,
okay.
No, what's very hard is to choose what we were going to put into the book. You know, Italian food is so widespread, and there's so many wonderful products of foods of Italy, and I would have loved to put each and every one of them in this book. Unfortunately, the book needed to be a certain size, and I had to select what I thought was basically the essential foods of Italy. And of course, cheese is one of them, and some of the cured meats are one. But by all means, there's so much more.
I know. I'm really looking forward to
I would
the
love
sequel.
To,
yeah, me too.
I would have loved to talk about risotto, the different types of rice that Italy has and the unique properties each have.
Chili.
I'd love to talk about the wonderful chocolates that Italy has from Sicily all the way up to Piemonte. And the other artisan type candies such as torrone, the nougat candy that Italy tries to take claim for, but actually it originated in probably the Mid East somewhere.
Oh, okay.
But there is so much more, and the types of bread is even a wonderful story in Italy, from Sardinia where they have this flatbread we call carta di musica, or pane carosau, to the bread from Altamura in Puglia, or the pizza bianca, which is a flattened focaccia bread from Rome. All through Italy, the piadina, they have these different breads. I would love to have included all this. Mm-hmm. We just didn't have the space.
Well, you've done a lot, because it occurs to me, you know, our knowledge culturally, or popular culture of Italian foods has a lot to do with who's saying what, who's using what, who's bringing back their most beloved products, and you've been a huge part of that.
I try to have products that would invoke memory as well. You know, Italy is one of the most favorite traveled places for Americans. Mm-hmm. And when they go to Italy and they go to a specific region, and that's why I try to cover it within these products, as many regions as possible. Because, you know, Italy, 20 regions, each with their own personality and food products. If you've been there, I wanted to invoke some of the memory. The book is not just about information through the stories of experiences of how I learned about these products. And throughout the book, there are other messages that I tried to bring forth. Messages pertaining to my grandparents and the special relationship they had with their community. Balsamic vinegar and the traditions of balsamic vinegar, not just what is it, but the traditions of it. And the story behind it so fits that agridulce, sweet and sour complexity of balsamic vinegar. So is life.
I enjoy the personal touches. I really like how you also said that you refer to Italy as 20 countries in one, because the regions just go back in time with history and unique cultures within them.
It's a younger country than the United States. Mm-hmm. And for the last 100 and some odd years that it's been a country, it's taken time for them to really come together, because they're so proud of their individual regions. And in some cases, their own provinces within the region are so diverse.
They actually legally changed the number of provinces in Italy while we were working on the book, which I think they've done many times in the past.
Quite a few, but doesn't mean that people accept it.
I know.
The Italians sometimes have difficulty accepting it.
So I wanted to talk about a slightly different topic, but sort of owing to the enthusiasm, the passion, and like the heritage of Italian foods that has continued to live on and thanks to your work and popular culture. You know, we've seen a lot of folks making mozzarella and now cured meats in the vein of the Italian traditions in America in the last few. Like, there's La Quercia making cured meats and, you know, several cheesemakers doing European-style cheeses of all kinds and breads. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, I've been saying in the last few years that America is trying to become like Europe and is really achieving that. And Europe is trying to become like America. And I don't know if that's such a good thing. You know, I mean, with our with the all the green markets that are opening up, with all these artisan producers that are going in, trying to make it work in some cases, you know, hard work and passion doesn't pay the bills. In some cases, it does. And I remember when Herb La Quercia first started, and his product is absolutely fantastic, wonderful. But what is a testament of how good his product is, mm-hmm. is the fact that it's more expensive than some of the finest Italian products that come in. Uh-huh. And why is it more expensive? Is because it's made on such a small scale, and it's made with so much attention to detail, and deserves to be more expensive. And he's able to do it, and I commend him for it.
Fantastic.
You know, as wonderful and as much as I love his product, my place is sort of a place that wants to represent the foods of Italy.
Right.
Naturally, if we can't get a certain product from Italy, we're going to source the best producer, and he is certainly one of the best producers of certain products.
Very interesting, yeah, how it's evolved. And of course, you're still making house-made mozzarella and ricotta, sure. made with milk grown in this country.
Yes, well, you got to remember, when my great-grandfather came here, there was no way to get fresh mozzarella from Italy. I mean, mm-hmm. they had steamships that had no refrigeration, and by the time it would be 2 or 3 days out to sea, the product would be no good anymore. Maybe even the same day, it wouldn't be any good anymore. But in the advent of air transportation, refrigeration mm-hmm. cargo, you're able to get a lot more of these highly perishable products.
What would you say to a lot of the sort of new generation of artisanal makers in America who might be trying to make products in the same vein as these DOP protected rituals that have been practiced and honed over centuries in Italy?
Well, it's a challenge. It's a challenge to maintain the quality, the integrity of the product, as well as maintaining the rules and regulations that our government puts into place. I mean, recently the government was stopping cheesemakers aging cheese on wood boards.
Right. And raw milk or something.
Well, and raw milk, I could understand why they don't want you to use raw milk, but you can if you meet certain requirements, aging the cheese for a certain length of time and using raw milk from dairies that you go and inspect and see that they're clean and a healthful environment and the cows are well treated. So, I mean, it requires effort and it requires a lot of dedication to really make sure, ensure that you're going to be able to provide the consumer not only with a great product, but also a healthful product.
Yeah, that's different set of challenge and different terroir. So what would you say to consumers who might be trying to eat only locally made foods?
I admire it. I try to eat as much locally produced vegetables. But remember, local means the environment that you're eating from is in a local environment. Mm-hmm. In food, especially in food products, the food will take the flavor of the environment.
Right.
The cows feeding, for instance, in Italy in the mountains, the milk will taste a lot different than cows that are feeding in the valley. And the cheese that it gives off will have different connotations.
Right.
One region to another region. Climate, right? Mm-hmm. Soil composition. All this plays a role. So locally produced vegetables are great because not only of the freshness, but you're actually eating within your own...
Right, you're experiencing
your own environment. But at the same time, you're missing out on...
You have a lot of limitations.
You have a lot of limitations.
Yeah. Right.
But strict locavores can actually eat DiPaolo's mozzarella and ricotta because the milk comes from here too, and it's made in Manhattan.
It's just an interesting conundrum with the two kind of forces of slow food and local food combining as one, because you know these traditions that people are making foods in Italy are so practiced and so careful and so thoughtful and slow, and yet they're imported. So it's it's a really interesting kind of movement that's happening, and you get to see both sides. Do you have any events coming up for the book?
Well, this weekend coming, I'm going to be in Newport, Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. In Newport, they have what they call the Newport Mansions Food and Wine Festival. And every year I do some seminars, and I speak about, this year I'm going to be speaking about some of the very special products from the Veneto, some cheeses from the Veneto, specifically Grana Padano, which is one of the most historic cheeses of Italy. And it's not as widely known in this country as of yet.
As Parmigiano Reggiano.
But it certainly has an older history. Where it comes from, when we were talking about areas, it's comes from above the Po River, mm-hmm. this very fertile grasslands from this Po Valley. We call it the breadbasket of Italy.
So the difference is where it's made.
And also the amount of fat that's in the cheese. If you're comparing it to Parmigiano, mm-hmm. it's a little less fat. It tends to be very sweet, but yet the protein crunch, that little granular crystals that you get, are very intense.
Mm. Great. That sounds like a fun event. Definitely check that out. I'm dying to ask, do you have an all-time favorite cheese of yours?
I got in a lot of trouble one year when I was doing an interview for a magazine, a specialty food magazine, and they cornered me, and they said, "What's your favorite cheese?" I said, I have over 300 cheeses that we represent, and I love them all, but if I had to choose one cheese, I had to choose a really good piece of Dolce Gorgonzola.
Ooh.
And they wrote that in the article, and this magazine was given out in the San Francisco Fancy Food Show, and I was there that year giving seminars, and I can't believe how many of the other cheese makers came in and said, "Luigi, why didn't you say my cheese was your favorite?" You know, I got in a lot of trouble.
I thought you were going to say squacquaroni.
That's John's favorite cheese from DiPaolo's.
Yeah, squacquaroni, believe it or not, Gorgonzola is an offshoot of the cheese called stracchino. And stracchino and squacquaroni are first cousins. So before there was a name Gorgonzola, it was known as blue stracchino. So it's sort of, you're in the same ballpark, Gorgonzola with a little bit of blue vein.
You're on the right track.
That's in that's in the mountain cheese chapter. There's a little bit of the history of Gorgonzola in there, right? Yes.
Well, it sounds like you picked an interesting cheese, so I can't wait to read that chapter. I haven't gotten to that. All right. Well, that's about all the time we have for today, but thank you again, Lou and Rachel and John. Congrats on the book.
Thank you so much. Check it out.
Just out now from Ballantine Books. And thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501(c)(3) nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.